Schumer gets taken for a ride, Menendez is about to be retried, and Stormy and Donald denied. A Making of the President edition of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. The shutdown may be over for now, but what about DACA? Will Congress get serious about immigration?
There was a word-of-mouth agreement that if these issues that they've been debating are not resolved by February 8th, that after that, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell will take up an immigration bill and bring it to the floor for open debate.
Plus, the feds want to retry New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez on corruption charges. Does this give Republicans a chance to end their long drought?
Not like you would anticipate. The Republican Party, unfortunately, in the state of New Jersey, is in shambles after the Christie administration. And there really is no one waiting in the wings.
And it was 50 years ago when the U.S. suffered an international humiliation, the taking of the USS Pueblo by North Korea.
The brave seamen of our people's army captured Pueblo, which was conducting espionage in our territorial waters. It was a severe punishment to the U.S. imperialist aggressors who violated the sovereignty of our country.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 213 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Still with a lot to say, and still with not much of a voice. Congress may be absorbed in the politics of the government shutdown, but nobody, at least not yet, is shutting down Robert Mueller. The special counsel, who has been methodically investigating President Trump and any potential obstruction of justice regarding Russia, has now interviewed Attorney General Jeff Sessions, the first member of the cabinet to be questioned. And so the next logical step is interviewing the president himself. Trump once agreed to that prospect, as he said to reporters last June.
Would you be willing to speak under oath to give your version of those
events? 100%.
Now, maybe not.
If Robert Mueller asks you to come and speak with his committee personally, are you committed still to doing that? Do you believe that?
Yeah, just so you understand. There's been no collusion. There's been no crime. And in theory, everybody tells me I'm not under investigation. Maybe Hillary is, I don't know, but I'm not.
In addition, he seemed to dismiss the investigation.
I can only say this, there was absolutely no collusion. Everybody knows it, every committee. I've been in office now for 11 months. For 11 months, they've had this phony cloud over this administration, over our government. And it has hurt our government. It does hurt our government. It's a Democrat hoax that was brought up as an excuse for losing an election that, frankly, the Democrats should have won because they have such a tremendous advantage in the Electoral College. So it was brought up for that reason. But it has been determined that there is no collusion, and by virtually everybody. So we'll see what happens.
But again, would you be open to
it? We'll see what happens. I mean, certainly I'll see what happens. But when they have no collusion and nobody's found any collusion at any level, it seems unlikely that you'd even have an interview.
Just in case you missed that, there's no collusion. But there is much more at play here. There's the issue of what Michael Flynn told investigators about what he knows. Between what he said, what Sessions said, and what former FBI Director James Comey said, it seems clear that Mueller is building a case of obstruction of justice against the president. No collusion. Not all the news this week was grim. Senator Tammy Duckworth of Illinois announced she's pregnant with a baby due in April. That would make her the first sitting member of the Senate in history to give birth. Nine other women have given birth while serving in the House. And if it's unusual to learn that a member of the Senate will be giving birth, it's not unusual to learn that the New England Patriots will play in the Super Bowl this year. It will be their second straight appearance and third in the past 4 years. Their opponents will be the Philadelphia Eagles. With two teams from the East competing in Super Bowl 52, that somehow gives us this week's trivia question. When was the last presidential election that featured two major party nominees who were born on the East Coast? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of our last trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned. Now it's the same old song, but with a different meaning since you've been gone. It's the same old song, but with a different meaning since you've been gone. The government shutdown, which dominated the political news and had the potential for going on for quite some time, ended with a whimper on Monday after just 3 days. Both sides agreed to a short-term fix on the budget, with the government funded now through February 8th, when lawmakers will either A, arrive at a long-term deal, or, more likely, B, come to another stalemate and repeat this process once again. It was Minority Leader Chuck Schumer who on Monday indicated that the shutdown was about to end with a speech on the Senate floor. But first came the jabs at the president.
President Trump turned away from not one, but two bipartisan compromises. Each would have averted this shutdown. Each would have led to a deal on the budget and health care and disaster aid and things like opioids and veterans and pensions and on immigration. My recent offer to the president was a generous one. I put his signature campaign issue on the table in exchange for DACA, and still, he turned away. President Trump's unwillingness to compromise caused the Trump shutdown and brought us to this moment.
But in the next breath, news of a deal.
After several discussions, offers, counteroffers, the Republican leader and I have come to an arrangement. We will vote today to reopen the government to continue negotiating a global agreement with the commitment that, if an agreement isn't reached by February the 8th, the Senate will immediately proceed to consideration of legislation dealing with DACA.
And the Senate went along.
On this vote, the yeas are 81, the nays are 18, the motion is agreed to.
But with so much left unresolved and so much finger-pointing going on, the obvious question is, what, if anything, was accomplished during the shutdown? And in political terms, who won and who lost? And will this be a campaign issue in the fall? We have two reporters from Roll Call to help sort it out. Simone Pathé is Roll Call's senior politics reporter, and Lindsay McPherson covers the House leadership. Simone and Lindsay, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Well, Simone, let me start with you. Explain, if you can, what Congress agreed to in ending the shutdown on Monday.
I'll leave the policy specifics to Lindsay because she covers that much more than I do. But in terms of sort of the politics of where things stand here, it seems like it's kind of up in the air until we reach this next deadline on February 8th.
Lindsay, give me the process.
Procedurally, there was just a word-of-mouth agreement from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell that if these issues that they've been debating for months now are not resolved by the next CR deadline, which is February 8th, that after that, he will take up an immigration bill and bring it to the floor for open debate. And the significance of that is there's currently, he had previously made a commitment on immigration saying if there was a bill that could get 60 votes in the Senate, I'd bring it up. This is not conditional on the votes being there. So they will move to debate on immigration regardless of where the votes stand. And for some senators, they feel like that's more than they were previously promised. But it doesn't guarantee any result. It doesn't guarantee anything on the other issues with the budget caps, disaster relief, various funding issues for opioids, community health centers, things like that Democrats had wanted. So they didn't get a ton out of this deal, if you look at it that way. But there is a, I guess, process moving forward that they've agreed to.
This is the fourth time that that basically Congress punted to another short-term stopgap spending deal. What do we think will be different about February 8th than was different, you know, this week?
Frankly, not much. I mean, the parties are pretty far apart on immigration, for example, even on, in terms of the spending issue itself, to get beyond the stopgap funding bills that we call here continuing resolutions, they need a deal on budget caps to raise the amount for defense and non-defense spending that was limited by the sequester. And they leaders say they're very, very close on that, but it's hard to see how they get that without an immigration deal because House leaders kind of see them intertwined, or at least House Democratic leaders, and I think Chuck Schumer as well knows that their leverage going forward is on those budget caps because Republicans can't pass an increase in the budget caps on their own.
Simone, let me ask you a basic political question. What was accomplished in shutting down the government, and did any side get what it wanted?
That's a great question. The short answer, I would say probably no. I mean, you could argue that maybe they have a little bit more leverage now that they have this promise, so to speak, from McConnell. But politically, Democrats certainly took a beating over the weekend in the headlines, at least, in terms of just what you alluded to, the fact that they didn't provide the votes to reopen the government and doesn't seem like, you know, even if voters will blame Republicans for the shutdown at large, some of these Democrats in potentially competitive Senate races could be in a tough spot if the shutdown gets framed against them in terms of immigration.
Well, Lindsay, expanding on that, I mean, if the Democrats ended the shutdown because McConnell promised, or he said it was his intention to have a debate and vote on DACA, that doesn't mean that the House is going to go along with it, does it?
No, definitely not. I mean, the House Republicans were saying, you know, throughout the shutdown that we're not bound to anything the Senate does. You know, we're not going to give them any agreement to vote on their bill that they've, you know, the bill they've been talking about over there is a pretty moderate to liberal proposal from Senators Dick Durbin and Lindsey Graham and other bipartisan senators that has no shot of winning support from House Republicans.
Simone, expanding on the issue of politics, what I noticed most, I guess what we all noticed most about the Democrats is that you had a bunch of those who may be in jeopardy in 2016, 2018, the Joe Manchins, the Heidi Heitkamps, the Joe Donnellys, the Claire McCaskills, who definitely don't want to be blamed for any shutdown. But then you also have this band of progressives or purists even, but who urged the shutdown to continue if there was no deal on DACA, the Elizabeth Warrens, the Kirsten Gillibrands, the Kamala Harrises, the Cory Bookers, and a lot of them, or many of them, may be looking at the White House. So if the party is split on that issue, at least on tactics, as was said earlier, does that further empower the Republicans?
You know, I think it really depends on senators doing best, what they think is best for their states, right? And you alluded to a pretty stark contrast here between the goals and the tactics, really, of folks who are up for re-election in 2018 and more progressive Democrats in the Senate who are clearly eyeing some 2020 campaign aspirations. And a lot of these red state Democrats who are up for re-election, all of them, in fact, voted to reopen the government except for Montana Senator John Tester. There was some Democratic polling, actually, from the Senate Majority PAC, which is the outside group run by Democrats to try to take back the Senate, right? And so they had found that overall Republicans would be blamed for the shutdown. But in those really five competitive Senate seats that Trump won, when the issue was framed around immigration, it actually flipped and Democrats were to be blamed. So whether this whole split emboldens Republicans or not, I think certainly they're going to try to run with that message, and they're going to try to attack these red state Democrats and tie them to the 2020 Democrats who voted against reopening the government. But really what you have here is, for the most part, Democrats up for re-election in 2018 looking out for their best interests and doing what they think will win them re-election in November.
But a lot of people are asking about, you know, always talk about, lately, they like to talk about winners and losers. Lindsay and Simone, both of you, whoever wants to start first, who were the winners and who were the losers in this 3-day shutdown?
I think that, from my perspective as a policy reporter, I think that the losers in terms of getting what they want on DACA are both Schumer and Trump. I think that just this prolonged, it was only 3 days, but these it only prolongs kind of their disagreements. Like that, this further highlighted the tension that exists on immigration within the Republican and Democratic parties, and their various viewpoints are very far apart. I think this kind of highlighted that, and that makes it harder to negotiate going forward. That Trump's going to dig in a lot more because he's pissed about how Schumer framed this, and Schumer's going to dig in more because he's pissed about how Trump framed it. I mean, they literally were calling it the Schumer shutdown, the Trump shutdown. So the two men who stand the most to lose are both of them, I think, going forward on the negotiations. Politically, someone might have some other insights.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not convinced long-term that there really are any winners and losers, and that could change, obviously, if on February 7th we are facing the same situation and go through this several more times. But in speaking to folks who work on the campaign side of things, first of all, it's just way too far out from November for this to really make a difference, and especially with the current political climate and the shortness of each news cycle, so many other things can happen between now and then. We all have been referencing the 2013 shutdown, for example, when it was assumed that Republicans would take the political hit, and they might have initially, but by the time the elections rolled around in 2014, there was Ebola, there was ISIS, there was the calamity over healthcare.gov, huge other issues that actually led to Republicans gaining seats that year. So politically, it's a little bit hard to figure out whether one side or the other really gained out of this.
And Chuck Schumer's pronouncement this week that he's going to pull back, he's going to rescind the offer made to fully fund the wall with Mexico, does that imperil all future negotiations about DACA and everything else as well?
It certainly throws a big wrench into it. I mean, I don't know, you know, how you move past it. Like, Republicans are pretty serious about the wall funding. And I mean, he's basically trying to call their bluff and think that this upcoming March 5th deadline, you know, when DACA is scheduled to end, will pressure them into some kind of bad deal. But I'm not sure. He also thought the government shutdown would pressure them into taking a different deal, and it didn't. So I'm not, he might be overplaying his hand here a bit. And going back to the winners and losers questions, I actually think one of the winners here is Mitch McConnell, because one of the things he said when he said, I'll bring up the immigration bill on February 8th, is that it's under the condition that the government must be open. So he's saying, Senate Democrats, if you filibuster the next, you know, short-term CR, we're all expecting another stopgap funding measure will be needed, and shut the government down again, then you don't get an immigration vote. So he's basically already preconditioned that Democrats will vote for the next funding bill and keep the government open. So that's a big win for him. He's avoided another shutdown by promising that. He's not promised an outcome on the immigration bill. He just promised to bring it up. He doesn't lose much by bringing something to the floor.
Let me end with a question to both of you. Come February 8th, are we going to be in the exact same position we were on Monday?
Go ahead, Lindsay.
I was just going to say, for literally what I just said, I don't think there will be a government shutdown, because the idea that the immigration bill will move forward to the floor is conditional on the government being open. So I don't think we're going to be in danger of another shutdown.
Simone?
I would just add to that I don't think the rhetoric is going to change. So, you know, even if there's not another shutdown, you're going to hear the same kind of finger pointing that we've heard for the past 5 days or so, with one side trying to hashtag this as the Schumer shutdown and the other side calling it a Trump shutdown. Both sides are trying to blame the other for this. And how long that remains in the minds of voters, I think we will have to see.
Simone Pathe and Lindsay McPherson, our political and congressional reporters with Roll Call. Thank you both for being on the show.
Thanks, Ken. Nice talking with you.
Thank you.
Shut it off, buddy, now I shut you down.
Do you remember this song?
I can see clearly now, the rain is gone. I can see all obstacles in my way.
It was the number one song in November of 1972. And do you remember this final out of the World Series with Pete Rose of the Reds at the plate?
Two down. Last of the night, 3-2 Oakland. There's a fly ball hit in the deep left center. Joe Rudy there. Oakland has won the 1972 World Series.
That was around the same time. I mention this not to torture my friends in Cincinnati, but to point out that November of 1972 was the last time the Republicans won a Senate race in New Jersey. And one would think that this year, in 2018, could be another opportunity for the GOP. Here's how NJ.com put it.
On Friday, the U.S. Justice Department announced that it will retry Democratic U.S. Senator Robert Menendez on bribery and corruption charges. The 64-year-old is accused of accepting private flights, campaign contributions, and other bribes from Florida ophthalmologist Solomon Melgen in exchange for official favors. Menendez, who has represented New Jersey in the Senate since 2006, is
But here's the hitch. No prominent Republican of any stripe has thrown a hat into the ring. And for the most part, the entire Democratic establishment is standing behind Menendez, who has given no indication he won't run for a third term this year. Aside from being a political science professor at Montclair State University, Bridget Harrison is our favorite New Jersey political analyst. And that's why she's on the program again this week. Hello, Bridget Harrison.
Hi, Ken Rudin.
Well, you know, I can't ask you to second-guess what the Justice Department's intention was to retry Menendez, but you know, as we saw with the Bob McDonald case in Virginia, this is the type of corruption that's so hard to end up in a conviction.
It really is, and what we saw in both the indictment but also throughout the trial is that, you know, Bob Menendez was guilty of associating with someone who wasn't behaving very admirably. But in terms of being able to prove corruption, we had 10 out of the 12 jurors, actually 11 out of 13 if you count one juror who was eventually dismissed, who were willing to give up days of their life to say that the U.S. senator was not guilty. It went on for days where they hung in there, and it resulted in a mistrial. And so it is rather surprising that the Trump administration would choose to move forward and retry this case.
Well, one would think, you know, I mean, I hate starting a sentence that way, but one would think that having to undergo another corruption trial at a time you're seeking re-election is not especially good news for your prospects. And I guess I read somewhere that the Senate Ethics Committee is going to take a look at this as well. So if nothing else, it's not something the Democrats want to see splashed across the front pages.
It is, and the timing matters. I think that particularly if this trial occurs during the election, you know, that is in the kind of weeks surrounding the November elections, that is particularly damaging. If the trial is speedy and is concluded by the summer, my thinking is that Menendez would again not be convicted and would be able to move forward without this distraction. But it is, we have to acknowledge, it is a cloud hanging over his head.
And yet the Democrats are standing behind him. Like, one of his most vocal supporters is Cory Booker, his fellow New Jersey senator. And Cory Booker is thought to have presidential ambitions. Is he taking any kind of a political risk?
Not in New Jersey. I mean, certainly could it come back to Cory Booker nationally that he backed Bob Menendez? Yeah, maybe. But here's the reality. You know, what Bob Menendez was tried for was essentially accepting campaign contributions and advocating for the individual from whom he accepted contributions. If that were a convictable offense, I think that we'd have to go after the entire U.S. Senate and the House of Representatives. And so I think that many sitting U.S. senators recognize that, including Cory Booker. But there is also this other kind of agenda that is going on. Bob Menendez has for a long time been the national leader of Cuban Americans and more broadly Latinos throughout the country. He has worked tirelessly for his colleagues in the Senate in their districts trying to rally Latino support. There are a lot of sitting U.S. senators who owe Bob Menendez, and I think that there is a recognition that in an era in which many Latinos feel rather persecuted by the federal government, Bob Menendez has been a longstanding, consistent, iconic voice for them, and it could, in fact, turn out to be politically beneficial to be backing Menendez among that constituency.
Whether or not Menendez is convictable or not, are there Republicans lining up to run against him?
Not like you would anticipate. And so, you know, the Republican Party, unfortunately, in the state of New Jersey, is left rather in shambles after the Christie administration. Chris Christie did not build a bench of Republicans. Witness the fact that his lieutenant governor was eviscerated at the polls, and there really is no one waiting in the wings. There may be some state legislators who might think about throwing their hat in the ring, but particularly given the expense that a U.S. Senate race will cost in New Jersey, we have a bifurcated media market, so you have to buy into two of the most expensive media markets in the country. You have to buy into New York and Philadelphia, meaning that our races tend to be amongst the most costliest, usually behind only New York and California. And so to have someone who can raise the kind of money that would be required, there aren't many establishment politicians with that capacity. We have heard one name. He is a pharmaceutical executive by the name of, it's Bob Hugin or Huggin, H-U-G-I-N. I don't know the gentleman. He was a supporter of Donald Trump and has been kind of trial ballooned as a potential candidate. He hasn't made any, you know, serious public announcements, that kind of thing. But in New Jersey, we tend to be accustomed to relatively affluent individuals walking in and being able to be pretty successful politically.
Are the Republicans taking a risk by not putting up a strong candidate? Because there is the possibility, I mean, I guess, I don't know how strong it is, but it is a possibility that Menendez doesn't run again, or that he even gets convicted. And for the party to be left without a candidate, that almost seems kind of like an opportunity lost.
I think that there's relatively widespread recognition and acceptance that there is no way that he does not run again. Bob Menendez is extremely angry at the charges that he faces and has been consistent in his defiance of these charges and has consistently stayed on message saying that he would run and has garnered the support essentially of the Democratic Party in the state of New Jersey. Even if he is convicted, it doesn't necessarily mean that he will be forced to give up the seat. That would take a vote in the U.S. Senate. And given the closeness of the party breakdown in the Senate, it isn't even clear that he would be expelled from the Senate.
You know, Menendez said something interesting back in November when the judge first declared a mistrial in the case. First, let me play this piece of tape here.
To those who left me, who abandoned me in my darkest moment, I forgive you. To those who embraced me in my darkest moment, I love you. To those New Jerseyans who gave me the benefit of the doubt, I thank you. To those who have a doubt, I'm going to work harder than ever before so that there is no doubt.
But then he said this.
To those who were digging my political grave so that they could jump into my seat, I know who you are, and I won't forget you.
Bridget, I think I can offer a guess on this, but tell me what you think he was referring to.
Oh, he was referring to former U.S. Senator Bob Torricelli, who made it patently clear that should Menendez be convicted or otherwise be removed from the Senate, that he wanted the seat. And, you know, it is interesting because Torricelli himself left the Senate under ethics investigation. And one thing that is very clear in New Jersey politics is that incumbency is incredibly important, and unless you're willing to risk your political career, you don't dare defy an incumbent, no matter how damaged that incumbent was. This was a lesson that was taught very loudly to a congressman by the name of Rob Andrews, who in the waning days of Frank Lautenberg's tenure in the U.S. Senate decided that he would challenge Senator Lautenberg, essentially saying that he was too old. And in a primary, Andrews was trounced, and essentially that began the downfall. You know, this was a rising star on the New Jersey political scene, someone that many people thought would move on to the U.S. Senate or the governorship. And essentially that act of defiance ended his political career because he was painted with the brush of disloyalty. And I think that Senator Menendez was essentially saying that Bob Torricelli now falls in that category.
And given the fact that Torricelli was known to have an awful relationship with Lautenberg and apparently also with Menendez, that may say something also about Torricelli's standing in the party.
Absolutely.
So what's your gut tells you that he will run a third term? That's what your gut says?
Yes, he will run barring anything that is unforeseen. And, you know, at this point, he lived through a trial. I don't know what could be unforeseen, what the DOJ would have come across that they did not come across in that first trial. So I can't imagine a scenario in which this very defiant, and you could hear it in that excerpt that you played, Ken, this very defiant U.S. senator who believes that he was persecuted for political reasons by a president of his own political party. I don't think that there's a whole lot of doubt that he intends to run for the third term.
And once again, once the election is said and done, we're going to continue saying, and the last Republican elected to in New Jersey was Clifford Case in 1972.
1972.
Bridget Harrison is a political science professor at Montclair State University. She can be found on Twitter at BriCalHar, BriCalHar. BriCalHar, as always, it's great having you on the program.
Thanks, Ken.
Look a little on the sunny side. Even when they say you're on the slide. And for a while, they'll say your records never make it. But in a while, they're gonna be showering you with praises. They'll give you mediocre reviews and put you in the underground for a while. But look a little on the funny, sunny side of life. Look a little on the sunny side.
With the worst job approval numbers of any first-year president, it's not a surprise that many people are critical, if not dismissive, of Donald Trump. We heard it last weekend at the women's marches around the country. Here was one marcher in Philadelphia speaking on CNN.
My message isn't that much different than it was last year. I have a lot of difficulty with understanding whether Donald Trump understands that there are other opinions in this world besides his.
Trump gets criticized by seriously concerned voters and mocked by satirists on late night television, such as this skit on Saturday Night Live.
And now it's time to play What Even Matters Anymore with your host, Veronica Elder.
To What Even Matters Anymore, the show where I tell you something our president did or said, and you have to tell me, does it even matter anymore? The president has an extramarital affair with a porn star right after his wife gives birth to a son. Then he pays the porn star to shut up. Does it even matter to say his evangelical base?
To evangelicals, of course it matters. It's against everything that they stand for.
You'd think so, but no. They say he's just repented and they forgive him, and Mike Pence is like, this my dude.
But not everyone is laughing. And the opposition is not comprised solely of liberals and anarchists, in case you're wondering. David Frum is a senior editor at The Atlantic and a former speechwriter for President George W. Bush. He is both a conservative and part of the Never Trump movement and is deeply concerned about what he sees as Trump's abuse of power. He is the author of a new book, Trumpocracy, The Corruption of the American Republic. David Frum, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Ken, thank you so much. It's good to see you again after we're last on a platform together in Los Angeles.
That's right, at Politicon. You know, not that I expected your book to be a laugh riot, but for the most part, maybe until the end, but for the most part, it was a pretty depressing read. I didn't come away particularly hopeful about the future.
Well, let me give you some reasons to be hopeful, because I think things are happening in this country that are exciting. One thing that I think we see is the rediscovery of the preciousness of truth. You hear this phrase, post-truth. It began not as an insult, but as a compliment. It started among certain kinds of advanced academics who wanted to reject truth as too dominating and suggested we should talk about truths instead. But what we're learning is the opposite of truth isn't truths. The opposite of truth is lying. And people are discovering that democracy can't stand official lying.
I guess we're talking about perhaps the person who resides at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, but let me talk a little bit about the Republican Party itself. I mean, it has the White House, it has both chambers of Congress, it has most governors, it has an overwhelming number of state legislators around the country. In 2016 alone, Donald Trump carried Iowa, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Florida, states Mitt Romney lost 4 years earlier. But something has happened to the Republican Party since the election of 2016. What has happened to it?
Well, something happened even in 2016, and all the things you list are overwhelmingly powerfully important. But let me contrast something. When the last time Republicans did this well was in the 1920s. I compare in the book the election of 2016 and the election of 1924, the Calvin Coolidge election, a big landslide for the Republicans. They were dominant up and down the ticket, federal and state. But in the 1920s, when they won everything, they also were strong in the centers of growth and innovation in the country. Calvin Coolidge got 55% of the vote in New York State, which is the financial heartland, an intellectual heartland of the country. He got 65% of the vote in Pennsylvania, the manufacturing heartland. He got almost 75% of the vote in the hub of the new economy of the 1920s, Michigan, where they were developing the automobile industry. Today's Republican Party, anywhere where people are inventing a product, anywhere they're writing a new song, anywhere where people are teaching the young, that's where they are weak, and they are strong where none of those things are happening.
So what you're saying is the Republican Party, well, obviously what you're saying is that the Republican Party has work to do, and how do you do that with a president that just seems to violate every norm, every political norm we've ever seen?
Well, it's more than work to do. I mean, this Republican Party is stranded, and one way to think about what's going on right now is to understand there really are two Republican parties. And I present an example in the book of what happened in the state of Pennsylvania in 2016. There are two statewide races that year for president and for U.S. Senator. Pat Toomey, the incumbent, was the U.S. Senator up for re-election, former president of the Club for Growth, a very typical Paul Ryan, cut taxes, cut spending kind of Republican. So both Trump and Toomey got almost identical shares of the vote, about 1.2 million votes for each person in the state. But Toomey outpolled Donald Trump by about 200,000 votes in the wealthy suburbs around Philadelphia and underperformed him by the same amount in the areas around Pittsburgh and the former mining areas. Whereas Donald Trump, he ran behind Toomey in the wealthy suburbs around Philadelphia and way ahead of him in the depressed parts of the state. So they have a lot of votes in common, obviously, but they have a lot of votes apart. And the difference in the Toomey party and the Trump party is something that is very threatening for the future of the Republicans.
Well, but, you know, when you talk about the two Republican parties, when voters go to the polls, they'll probably see one Republican party. And the reason I say that is I'm thinking back to the 1974 elections with Nixon and Watergate weighing the party down. Many Republicans insisted that they shouldn't be blamed for the scandal in Watergate, but they went down to defeat anyway. I think of what happened in 2006 with Bush and the war in Iraq and Katrina and food prices, everything that was rising food prices, everything that was hurting the GOP. And Republicans like Nancy Johnson and Jim Leach and others like that, who really were not part of this seeming problem, they also went down to defeat. So I'm wondering, even though you're talking about two separate Republican parties, if there is an anti-Trump wave, if there's an anti-Trump sentiment in the country, and right now his numbers are not great, that would bring down Republicans of whatever stripe, whether it's Pat Toomey or some more moderates in the House.
I don't disagree that the Republicans are heading for a lot of trouble, and it's the fault with Donald Trump. The title of my book, Trumpocracy, reflects not just Trump's personality, but his structure of power. And in that structure of power...
Dave, can I just interrupt for a second? I was just thinking that it seems like whenever time there's a criticism of Trump, it always talks about his personality, and it talks far less about his use or abuse, as some people would say, of power.
For sure. Look, his personality is so gothic, I mean, so outsized. Of course it draws attention, and every day he seems to do something cruel or faithless or outrageous. But none of this would be happening if he weren't enabled and empowered by a White House staff, by his party in the Congress, by the Republican donors in the country, and by millions of rank-and-file Republicans. They make it possible, and they're part of the story, and that's the story I'm trying to tell.
Well, I guess my follow-up question is, what happened to a party that, you know, once was very suspicious of Russia and now, at the very least, seems more critical of the FBI or the intelligence agencies or the Justice Department than they do of Vladimir Putin?
It's becoming a new kind of party. It's becoming a party like these ethno-nationalist parties we see across Europe. And it's moving in a direction of having a lot more in common with the French National Front than with the Republican Party of Mitt Romney. And it's also doing something else. And this is another feature of this Trumpocracy I talk about. Realizing that its ideas are not popular and that it can't win a majority of the vote if everybody voted, instead of amending its ideas to make them more acceptable to voters, it's amending the electorate to make it, to shrink it so that it will accept Republican ideas.
You know, your book chronicles the president's actions with his overreaches, his treatment of the press, his disdain for his enemies, his disregard for the truth. And maybe this is not even important, but is your conclusion that Trump is uninformed or ignorant of the facts, or lazy, or Does he know exactly what he's doing? This is all part of a master plan.
Trump does not have plans, but he is a keenly intuitive politician with the bully sense for where people's vulnerabilities are. Not just individual human political opponents like Jeb Bush or Hillary Clinton, but the American political system, which has become his enemy. He understands how mutually rancorous Americans are right now, and that he can gain a lot of loyalty for himself from people who might not like him otherwise, because they care so much more about what they oppose than about what they believe.
You know, one thing I wondered after reading your book, no matter how long Trump stays in office, whether it's 3 more years or for 2 terms or you know, forever if they cancel all elections, but will this ever become the new normal? I mean, in other words, after he's gone, does the party revert to a Jeb Bush or Bob Dole kind of establishment figure, or has the party changed forever?
Look, the politics have changed forever. We're not going back to the politics of the 1970s or even the 1990s. We face new problems. The reason Donald Trump was able to overthrow so many figures on his way to control the Republican Party was because they were talking about things that meant nothing, and he was talking about things that meant something. You know, when Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush talked about hope, growth, and opportunity, and the best America is yet to come, the Republican electorate thought they were talking gibberish. When Donald Trump spoke in terms of despair about drugs and about deindustrialization, they heard what he was saying. Now, he didn't have useful or responsible contributions to make, but at least he was addressing the present. I think whatever comes after Trump, it will be rooted in the present. We're not going back to Bob Dole's Republican Party.
Then here's another question. Would it have been better for the Republican Party or for the country or for David Frum even if Hillary Clinton had won the election?
I disagree with Hillary Clinton on so many things, but I credit her with this. She's a patriot. If she were president now, the Russians would be paying a price for their interference, not only in American elections, but in the elections of our allies. And she would be leading a coalition of allies to in defense of South Korea instead of, as Donald Trump was suggesting, shrugging off, well, you know, maybe a few thousand casualties or a few hundred thousand casualties in South Korea is a price worth paying to safeguard the United States.
Let me ask you a question, a broader question about your book. What actually is the audience for your book? And the reason I ask that is that it seems like Trump supporters will continue to love him and Trump foes will continue to despise him. But in the end, can it change minds? Does it change minds? Should it change minds?
In many ways, I'm the worst person to ask because you just write a book and then you see what other people think about it. But here are two things I can point out, the services that it might make. The first is you don't defeat presidents by changing their base. In 1932, with Americans literally going hungry, Herbert Hoover still got 38% of the vote. I'm sure there are a lot of Americans in 1932 who said, well, I don't appreciate being hungry and homeless. On the other hand, I do appreciate Mr. Hoover's stand against beverage alcohol, so I'll vote for him. Or there are Americans who said, yeah, I'm worse off than I was 4 years ago, but the Republicans are the party of Lincoln and the Democrats are the party of lynching. So and even then, you hold your base. You lose when you lose the people around your base, the fringe. So I'm talking to some of them. But what I also want to do is give Trump critics a better vision of what the issue is, because I think there are some really serious misunderstandings of the nature of the danger we're in. Both people are too complacent. They say, well, these institutions are strong. They will hold. I documented the book, the many ways in which the institutions are yielding. And even of more concern are those who overstate it and who say, who look back to the 1930s and the fascist movements of that long ago era to understand what is going wrong with democracy in the 2010s. There are a lot of stops on the train line of bad before you get to Hitler Station. Donald Trump is not like the 2010s are not like the 1930s, and the dangers of the 2010s are not like the dangers of the 1930s. So I want to give people tools to understand accurately what they face.
David Frum is a senior editor at The Atlantic and author of the new book, Trumpocracy, The Corruption of the American Republic. David, I'm sorry I got depressed about everything.
There's hope.
I promise I do not blame you, and I don't blame your book.
What a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of our last trivia question, which was, when was the last presidential year in which neither the Democratic nor Republican winner in the Nevada primaries or caucuses later became their party's nominees? The answer, 2008. That year, Mitt Romney won the Republican primary in Nevada, but the nomination went to John McCain. And Hillary Clinton carried the Democratic caucuses, but Barack Obama became the nominee. And the randomly selected winner is Christopher Scales of Hamilton, New Jersey. Christopher wins the coveted political junkie button. And we have a scuttle button winner as well. That's that waste of time contest where you need to take a word or a concept from each button I post, and then come up with a familiar saying or slogan. The last contest had just two buttons. The first said, I love Ringo. That's Ringo Starr, of course. He was a drummer of the Beatles. And the second read, no more Koreas. U.S. get out of Vietnam. Two wars that didn't go so well. So when you combine Star and Wars, you kind of get Star Wars, the series of movies created by George Lucas that began in 1977. And the randomly selected winner is Harvey Kaufman of Belmont, Massachusetts. The new Scuttle Button puzzle is already up on our website. You can find that as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all at krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Star Wars, nothing but Star Wars. Give me the Star Wars, don't let them end. Star Wars, if they should fire wars, please let these Star Wars stay.
It's time for This Week in Political History. 50 years ago this week, if you were living in, say, North Korea, you would have heard this on the news.
The great leader Kim Jong-il said as follows. The brave seamen of our People's Army captured Pueblo, the armed spy ship of the U.S. imperialists, which was conducting espionage in our territorial waters, and over 80 aggressors on board a ship. It was a severe punishment to the U.S. imperialist aggressors who violated the sovereignty of our country. Pueblo, armed spy ship of the U.S. imperialists.
If you were not fortunate enough to be living in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea at the time, and instead were living in, say, the U.S., you might have heard this on ABC News from anchor Bob Young.
14,600 naval and air reservists and National Guardsmen from coast to coast have been called up to active duty immediately. President Johnson is putting muscle in his demands that North Korea release the USS Pueblo and her 83 men. It's the first reserve call-up since the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962 and the largest mobilization of men since the 1961 crisis in Berlin.
50 years ago this week, a lightly armed American spy ship, the USS Pueblo, was in international waters off the coast of North Korea when it was attacked and seized by ships from the communist country. One American was killed and the remaining 82 crew members were imprisoned, forced to sign confessions, and tortured. They were released 11 months later, 2 days before Christmas. In the horrific year of 1968, it was hardly the worst thing that happened, but it was a complete humiliation for the U.S. and its president, Lyndon Johnson, who at the time was still presumed to be running for re-election. He would drop out of the race 2 months later. Jack Cheevers wrote the defining book of the incident, Act of War, Lyndon Johnson, North Korea, and the Capture of the Spy Ship Pueblo. Jack, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me, Ken.
Well, you know, we've long been told that one of the reasons why President Johnson didn't want to withdraw from Vietnam was the humiliation it would bring, the first president to lose a war. But if nothing else, the Pueblo incident was incredibly humiliating for Johnson and the U.S.
Well, that's very true. It was something that nobody expected, and it definitely shocked the entire country. There were all kinds of calls in our country for military retaliation against North Korea. But Johnson really had his hands full with the Vietnam War, and the last thing he wanted was a second land war in Asia. So he decided to go the diplomatic route, and ultimately that was successful. He did manage to get all 82 of the surviving sailors home, as you mentioned, just before Christmas in 1968. But the ship, of course, is still in North Korea's hands to this day.
Right. It's now a tourist attraction, right?
Right, a very popular tourist attraction. A lot of Americans and Western Europeans have been on board it and played with the machine guns and looked at all the code equipment and the innards of the ship. And the North Koreans are quite proud of it. They regard it as a war trophy and an emblem of their victory over the imperialist aggressors back in 1968.
Were the people in this country outraged over this? I mean, you mentioned there were demands for American retaliation, or, as you say, was... Given what was going on in Vietnam, I think the Tet Offensive took place around the same time. Like everything felt like it was falling apart, and Johnson was just, you know, pulled in so many different directions.
You're absolutely right. The Tet Offensive started just a few days after the Pueblo was captured at the end of January 1968. And, of course, that immediately seized all the media attention in this country. It was a very dramatic battle that was waged all over South Vietnam as thousands of Viet Cong fighters struck cities and towns literally all across the country. A lot of people will remember that they actually managed to get inside the grounds of the U.S. Embassy in Saigon before the Marine Guards beat them back. And that was the thing that dominated the headlines for the next several months, because the offensive kept going on, and the Pueblo did hit the front pages. It was a major story at the time. But as the negotiations got underway in North Korea for the return of the sailors, it became kind of a secret story and was much less in the news for the next several months, and all sorts of other things were happening in that year, 1968. It was one of the most turbulent years in American history. You mentioned Johnson deciding not to run for a second term in 68. It was also the year that Bobby Kennedy was killed, that Martin Luther King was murdered. The Soviets invaded Czechoslovakia that year. There was all the rioting at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago that year. And at close to Christmas time, Apollo 8 was headed for the moon. So it was a very busy year.
You know, I found a speech by Richard Nixon that called the Pueblo capture, quote, an incredible blunder. But he also called for, I'm quoting here again, firm diplomacy and not rash action. And yet, on the other hand, there were some members of Congress who were calling for declaring war or seizing North Korean vessels. Everett Dirksen was talking about Johnson's policy of appeasement. But in retrospect, was there anything that Johnson could have done to get the release of the ship?
Well, what Johnson did was rattle the saber, the U.S. military saber, as loudly as he possibly could. He sent an armada of naval warships into the Sea of Japan, close off North Korea, led by the USS Enterprise, the nuclear-powered aircraft carrier. He also sent about 360 combat aircraft to bases in South Korea, in Japan, Okinawa, all within striking range of North Korea. The idea was to put as much military pressure on the North Koreans as possible without actually pulling the trigger. But the North Koreans were very stalwart in their determination to hold on to the crew and the ship. Johnson's advisors, military and national security advisors, secretly worked out a series of military options. There were 10 different options. They included things like seizing a North Korean warship, launching an armored attack through the demilitarized zone into North Korea. There was a whole series of options, but none of them really would have gotten the crew back alive, which is really what Johnson's goal was, and all of them risked escalating the situation. And the real fear of Johnson and his advisors was that they would do something that would result in North Korea invading the South, or alternatively, South Korea invading the North. There was a tremendous amount of tension between the two Koreas at the time, and there was a real powder keg on the Korean Peninsula. And last, like I mentioned earlier, the last thing Johnson and his folks wanted was to wind up with a second war in Asia on their hands.
My goodness, I'm sitting and listening to you describe all this, and it sounds very 2018, doesn't it? Except for the different kinds of temperament from the people inside the White House, Johnson and Trump, but it just the saber rattling, the threats, the sending more weaponry off the Korean coast, it just sounds like it's present day politics.
Yeah, there are a lot of parallels with 2018. And of course, the you know the big difference between now and 1968 is that North Korea now has nuclear weapons as well as missile technology, and there's a real danger that they could start hitting us with nuclear-tipped missiles if we go after them in some sort of military way.
In addition to the humiliation of the ship being taken in the first place, the members of the Pueblo, including the commander, Pete Booker, made a public confession, obviously under duress. Let me play a little bit of that tape.
We intruded into the territorial waters of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea and committed hostile acts, and sincerely apologizes for these acts and gives assurance that they will not be repeated.
That was pretty controversial, wasn't it?
It was very controversial. The American public hadn't been exposed to this sort of thing very often. It had been the Chinese had done it to our POWs in during the Korean War. They had basically pressured some of our captives into giving these kind of propaganda speeches, which were, of course, broadcast all around the world. But this was something that America in 1968 didn't have much exposure to. And what was going on in the background is that the North Koreans had placed Captain Booker under extraordinary duress to get him to make these propaganda broadcasts. For example, he was put in a room one day, and the North Koreans said, unless you sign this confession, it was a written apology they wanted him to sign, we're going to bring your crew members in here one by one, we're going to blow their brains out, and we're going to keep doing it until you sign this thing. And if you don't do it at the end, we have other ways of making you sign it. And Booker was trying to figure out in a few seconds what he should do. Should he, you know, roll the dice and resist signing it, or should he go ahead and sign it? And they brought one of his crewmen into the room, a 19-year-old seaman named Howard Bland, and they said, we're going to start with this guy. Either sign this document or we're going to kill this guy right in front of you. Another occasion, they brought him into basically a torture dungeon, and they showed him a South Korean man that they had captured, and he was strapped to the wall. He had been horribly tortured. One of his arms had been broken, and the bones were sticking out. He had chewed through his lower lip, which was dangling off of his mouth. I mean, Booker was placed under so much pressure, it's hard to even imagine what he went through. He wasn't doing this voluntarily. And Johnson's people were trying to figure out, well, why was he doing this? Was he a traitor? Had the North Koreans given him drugs? Had they bribed him in some way to do this? And it never occurred to them that he was doing it because he was being placed under tremendous, tremendous psychological and physical duress.
And then when the crew was released, I mean, there was talk about an inquiry into the actions, talks about court-martials. I mean, that must have been brutal on him. I know for your book, you had conversations with Commander Booker. What was his state of mind about all of this so many years later?
Well, you're right. I did talk to Pete Booker on a number of occasions. I spent many hours with him and his wife, and I enjoyed Pete Booker a great deal. I thought he was a good naval officer. I thought he was a very brave man, and I thought that he did his best. I thought he did his best to evade the North Koreans when his ship, which was completely unprotected and completely unprepared for any kind of serious combat at sea, was attacked by six North Korean gunboats and two MiG fighters. And I thought he did a tremendous job in trying to lead and protect his men in the 11 months they spent in prison. And most of the time, they were subjected to torture and all sorts of psychological abuse. The North Koreans beat them constantly, knocked them down with rifle butts, stuck pointed rifles at their heads and cocked them. This was a very, very difficult time. And I think that Pete Booker did really a tremendous job in leading his men during particularly their time in prison.
Jack Cheevers is the author of Act of War, Lyndon Johnson, North Korea, and the Capture of the Spy Ship Pueblo. Jack, it was great having you on the program.
Thanks very much. My pleasure, Ken.
It was 50 years ago this week, on January 23rd, 1968, when a U.S. spy ship, the Pueblo, operating in international waters off the coast of North Korea, was seized by communist gunboats. Its crew was held hostage and often tortured during their 11 months in captivity. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie.
Compel, but not defeat.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.